And ask them if during the interim they would come over and make a presentation to us of the status of their planning and thoughts about the future of the Metrodome. And of course, in the recent week or so, we've seen activities by the Vikings owner buying land in downtown Minneapolis, and the Sports Facilities Commission is, as I understand it, planning a series of meetings around the state to talk about the future of professional football in this state and a site for them to operate in. So we're very pleased this morning to, on behalf of my committee, to also welcome Senator Kubley, Senator Dibble, who are members of Senator Tomassoni's Economic Development Division, to hear the presentation from Chair Terwilliger and Mr. Terwilliger and Mr. Lester and others. So without any further ado, welcome to the committee, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and good morning. For the record, I'm Roy Terwilliger, Service Chair of the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. Good to see all of you again. I appreciate the opportunity for us to be here. Before we start the presentation, I would also like to mention that Vice Chair of the Commission, Loann Thrain, is here, sitting in here this morning. And we're pleased that she can be here, and I don't believe any other members of the Commission are here with us, but if they do come in, I will identify them. The Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission is a body consisting of seven people, six of whom are appointed by the City of Minneapolis City Council, and the seventh appointed by the governor, and that happens to be the chair, and that's a position I hold. And
Mr. Terwilliger, these mics don't amplify, so I'm going to have to ask you to speak louder.
Oh, okay.
If you will.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I should remember that. Anyway, the commission has the charge of a couple of things. One, to certainly retain professional football and baseball in Minnesota and oversee the facilities necessary to do that. As the Metrodome sits now, it sits on 20 acres in downtown Minneapolis, which is prime real estate. And during the past couple of years, as you recall, both the Twins and the Gophers situations have changed. The Twins will be leaving for their new ballpark in 2010. If everything stays on schedule, the Gophers will be leaving in 2009. The use agreement for the other major tenant, the Vikings, expires at the end of the 2011 football season. What we did then, in concert with looking at the responsibility that we have, not only to as a landlord, but also as the people running this facility, was to begin late last summer, looking at what would be the art of the possible, what is going to be the situation as we proceed through 2009, through 2010, and indeed 2011. The Metrodome is a multi-purpose public facility, happens to have three major league tenants in it. However, it is used 300 event days a year. I think a little known fact is that the facility is utilized by a lot of different groups for many different purposes. So it is in many ways Minnesota's living room. It has 300 event days, and they take out the Twins and the Gophers when they leave, and even the Vikings were down to 200 and some event days. Such events as the State High School League playoffs, the Hmong New Year, something such as the Promise Keepers or Billy Graham Crusade tractor pulls, or anything such as that. So it's a facility that has been very well utilized over its 25 years of existence. It does not provide a burden on the taxpayer, outside of the fact, obviously, it does not pay property taxes. but it is a facility that has been very well used over the years, has a great history of events that have been there. As you know, it's probably the only facility. It is the only facility that's had two World Series, had, you know, two Final Fours, has had a Super Bowl, any number of other types of events, whether it be state high school league playoffs or whether it be small college baseball. The facility has been very versatile, has been a very good investment for the public over the years. But now the reality sets in. It sits on 20 acres there. What next for the Metrodome? And so in the responsible way, we've been attempting to begin a conversation not only with the policymakers but across the state with all people, citizens of this state, about the need for this multi-use facility and how do we deal with it in the future as it as the needs evolve in the state. The situation is much like it was probably 30 years ago when the legislature set up what is now the current facility and began to work with that. There's a rising level, I believe, of expectations on behalf of people who frequent these types of events. You can look at the Civic Center and see what that evolved into with the XL Center. When you look at the baseball park from the old Met Center to the Metrodome, now to the new ballpark, there are a lot of amenities that are in there that become very much expected. And so what is our role in providing the look at the future and where we're going to go? The facility, as I mentioned, is 25 years old, operates with no tax subsidies, has no debt, has reserves of approximately $16 million in its accounts.
Mr. Twiggler, how fast was the Metrodome debt paid off?
Well, I'm going to turn to Bill Lester, who's the executive director, who's here to make certain we have those that accurate answer to that question.
Mr. Lester?
Madam Chair, members, the debt was retired in...
You need to say your name for the record.
Pardon me? Oh, I'm sorry. Bill Lester, executive director of Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. And the Metrodome debt was retired in 1998. Outstanding bonds were defeased. And it was through a combination of operations, revenue from operations, plus the sale of the land in Bloomington for the Mall of America and the additional land sale for what will become the next phase of the Mall of America. Those allowed us to pay off the remaining debt and fill the accounts necessary to operate the facility.
So it's been debt-free for 10 years?
9 years, right.
9 years.
Okay. Correct, Madam Chair.
Thank you.
So our hope, thank you, Madam Chair. So our hope today is to go into great detail. Bill will go into more detail than I am doing here, and then we will call in Craig Skyme from CSL, and as well as Representative Bruce Chamberlain from Hoisington Kegler, the planning group. Last fall, when I mentioned a few moments ago that we'd begun to look at where we go, what next for the Metrodome. And at that time, we engaged a design firm out of San Francisco, Roma. The pictures you see are from Roma, and they associated with Hoisington Kegler, which is a local planning firm that has done the Downtown East work in downtown Minneapolis. They collaborated, and we engaged approximately another 10 consulting firms on various aspects of looking at the vision as to where we're going, and this is what we hope to lay out for you today, is to talk about that and to begin that conversation, respond to any questions you might have to the best of our ability. As I mentioned, Bill Lester, who's already identified himself, has been executive director of the Sports Commission since 1987, so has been through a good deal of the ups and downs of all of the needs there. It comes with great experience, and I'm going to ask Bill if he would comment on where we go from here.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. We also should add that the Minnesota Vikings vice president in charge of facility development, Lester Bagley, will also make a few remarks at the end and answer any questions that are more appropriately directed to the Vikings.
Thank you.
I should say that when I started this job, I was 17 years old and had jet black hair.
I'm sorry.
A lot of it. the timeline that we're looking at for the Metrodome next is anticipates the use agreement for the Vikings expires at the end of the 2011 football season. So this is predicated on the appropriate actions, design, procurement, construction for an opening of a new facility of multi-purpose, retractable roof, climate-controlled facility in 2012. And we'll also, others who are speaking will get into that more specifically.
I might just mention to members that paper copies of the PowerPoint are also in your
That is correct, Madam Chair. I neglected to say that. All the presentations are in the packet that was handed to you. This slide articulates the rising costs, and as you might expect, costs go up as you delay in the 4 to 5% a year range for the cost of construction of the facility. The Metrodome next, some of this is I'll go through quickly because the chair outlined it earlier, but we started in December of 2006, and the idea is, what is the art of the possible? We recognize that this is a sensational asset to have in this state. Having the team allows you to have the facility. Once you have the facility, it is your obligation, this commission feels, to maximize its return for the community. And the way you do that is you fill it those other 200 event days a year. So you can have the people from Pipestone and the people from throughout the state of Minnesota come in and play football for the playoffs, and girls soccer and boys soccer for their playoffs. And it has become an integral part of the presentation of those events and an integral part of the ability of the State High School League and others to maximize their use and also deliver a return for their participants. We also considered the impact it would have. We wanted to do this more comprehensively, and that is when the Metrodome was constructed, one of the neighbors at a meeting, we had a neighborhood meeting, said that it was as if a giant spaceship had been plunked down in the middle of the eastern part of the city and destroyed all indigenous life around it, which I thought was kind of a clever way of saying it. We don't want that to happen. What we would like to do is integrate it into what is already there to not compete with where existing infrastructure has already been built, but to maximize that infrastructure and also to maximize what the city has already done with its Downtown East Master Plan. This is a list of the consultants. I'm not going to go through them. They're all in your packet.
Excuse me, Mr. Astor. We're probably going to have a number of questions as we go along.
Sure, that's fine, Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is on the subject of development in the area of the existing stadium, if Mr. Lester could help us understand, other than, you know, some of the new developments, you know, some of the new vitality that we're seeing along the Washington Avenue corridor. What is your analysis of why there's been such a dearth of vitality and activity around the existing Metrodome?
Madam Chair, Senator, it's a great question. And at least the commission wasn't the one that sold the idea that if you plunk something down, development will automatically occur. It will not. If you plunk down an LRT station, it will not automatically occur. It will occur if it's part of a strategic integrated plan, overall plan, for what will occur in the area. And not immediately. It doesn't all happen the first day. Some of these are 10, 20, and 30 years before they come to fruition. But very clearly, the land was available where the Metrodome was built. The competition with Bloomington eventually favored downtown Minneapolis for a site, and it was built where the site was available. I would, though, Senator, also like Bruce Chamberlain, who worked on the original Downtown East Master Plan, to also comment on how we see this as potentially the next great place for development to occur.
Great, thank you. Although, Madam Chair, I'll say,
Senator Dibble,
this dome is 30 years old, so if we're waiting for 30 years for something to happen, then probably the next dome will be ready to be dropped and something else will be coming, you know, in its place. So I hope we're not actually looking at 30-year horizons.
Mr. Lester.
Senator, Madam Chair, that's an excellent point, and I would like Bruce to comment on that. Why don't we wait to do it so it's a little more.
Right, thank you.
Okay. Mm-hmm. We think the community needs a retractable roof with the benefits that confers to the state and its political subdivisions, but primarily to its people. The city of Seattle has said that these other events are not important. They have two open-air stadiums. one for baseball, one for football. They no longer compete for NCAA Final Four events. They no longer compete for any events that require a large capacity venue. The motorsports, they don't do that. They've opted not to. Other cities like Indianapolis have said these are important to our community. These are gagging numbers. These are difficult to swallow. But nonetheless, if we want to make a significant investment that will redound to the benefit of not only this generation but future generations, you have to bite the bullet and do that. Also outlined in your report are historic costs and benefits of stadium developments in this community and others. We've also outlined, we did an enormous amount of research, and Mr. Skime, who will follow me, can talk about some of that. Some costs on redevelopment of the existing site, which I'll have here in a second. And then we also tried to enumerate direct and indirect benefits of a redevelopment on the existing site. The Dome itself, more than 77 million people have visited the Metrodome since it opened in 1982. It now remains one of the last three multi-purpose facilities. Miami still has professional football and baseball, and Oakland does. Other than that, every other city has gone to a single-purpose facility, which primarily only hosts their 81 baseball or their 10 football, Viking or professional football. And Senator Twilliger, the chair, noted that we hosted a Super Bowl, an All-Star Game, two Major League Baseball World Series, two NCAA Final One, men's Final Four, as well as set the record for the Timberwolves. It has been a marvelous investment and a marvelous return given the way we've been able to maximize its usage. The availability of a year-round facility to accommodate such a wide range of sporting, entertainment, commercial, and civic and community activities is an important contributor to our state's quality of life. The Metrodome, as it currently configured, no longer satisfies the needs. If we are going to compete with St. Louis's, the Atlanta's, the Denver's of the world, then it's difficult and it's hard, but it's something that's going to be necessary. We've made a terrific and albeit painful investment in light rail transit and the North Star commuter and other significant public works projects. This is another one that, in our estimation, the estimation of the commission, should be completed as well. The fans and event organizers want the generous number of, these are all building elements where you add to the number of concessions, restroom facilities, especially for women, the wide and tall concourses, wide seats, and all of these elements that occur in the new state-of-the-art facility. And those of you who have visited XL Energy Center are well aware of what that can mean for the experience of the fans. Professional sports leagues and teams seek numerous well-equipped and well-located suites. This all has to do with the revenue generation capability of the facility. Again, having the team allows you to have the facility, and once you have the facility, it's incumbent upon us to make sure it gets used in every way possible. The Metrodome has been able to, today, provide those benefits, but to the extent that we can, but it's limited by, this is basically 70s technology that we used on the Metrodome. Of the 31 NFL teams, the Metrodome is the oldest, not in the process of being replaced or renovated substantially. All of the teams in the NFC Central will play in new or substantially renovated stadiums, all built since 2003. And with the exception of New Orleans, all of the dome stadiums of that generation have been replaced, the Silver Dome, the King Dome, and the RCA Dome in Indianapolis.
What are they doing in New Orleans? Did they just repair the Superdome?
Yeah, Madam Chair, with the damage from, really it was destroyed during Katrina and the aftermath of Katrina. It was taken over by the citizens, and it really the internal structure was destroyed. So
what did they do with it?
They got significant amount of money, including some from the NFL and some from the federal government, and they rebuilt it.
They rebuilt it.
And then opened it up, had a grand opening
on the same
year.
Site, right?
It's with the same exterior of the building, the same skin, and then they rebuilt it basically from the inside out. The three options the commission sees are the status quo, they continue as is, and hope nothing drastic happens with the Vikings after their use agreement expires, to do a major refurbishment, and I'd like to talk about that for a second. We did do a thorough analysis in 2001 on the potential for renovation of the Metrodome. We have, because the question has come up about renovation of the Metrodome, we have also enlisted LRB Beckett, which is a Minnesota-based firm, to update that analysis as well as look at so that we can answer any questions about the costs of that and what you can get when you finish if you try to renovate a facility that was built really completely for about $88 million and what you could do to that and how much it would cost. And we will have that information ready by August of this year. And finally, a new facility. And so if we're focusing on a 30-year solution as opposed to a 10 or 15-year solution or even a 50-year solution, then a new facility that encompasses all of the latest state-of-the-art and all of the anticipated needs that you would have as a community, the commission has come down on the side, at least at this juncture, of a new facility. The significant advantage of the current site is it uses infrastructure. All the roadways, access ramps, surface, utilities, transit lines are in and operating and paid for. And events that occur at these kinds of facilities occur during non-peak hours. So the 160,000 people who go to work in downtown Minneapolis every day are gone home, or they might be staying for the game, but that's vacating, and it allows us to maximize the investment the public has already made in this type of infrastructure. Duplicating the infrastructure at another location would add hundreds of millions of dollars to the project. The key findings in our analysis are it would cost, with a retractable roof, climate controlled, would cost approximately $954 million. That's in 2010 dollars, anticipating, as we know, the inflation that will occur. The redevelopment of the Metrodome site will positively impact Downtown East, in part because the site itself will be reconfigured, and I'm going to have Mr. Chamberlain speak to that. This is a breakdown, and you have it in your folder, and obviously, if, as you review the materials, we only handed this material out today, so if you review that, we'd be glad to answer any questions, and either through your chair or staff or directly if you care to. We anticipate that the redevelopment of the Metrodome site would have a positive impact on the development of Downtown East, in large part because the site itself will be reconfigured to enable additional space for development to occur. You'll see that. The stadium redevelopment plan will allow for a new development area and a public plaza of as much as 144,000 square feet. Otherwise, this is the only way this space would be freed up for this kind of use. The benefits of redevelopment are significantly enhanced if done in conjunction with the selection of a master developer, though not exclusive. One of the drivers, when we talk about these projects, we see that there are a number of drivers on development. A stadium in and of itself, as we said previously, won't drive development, but it can be one of the drivers. And another driver is a developer who owns the team who's willing to invest significant millions of dollars in order to make sure that that happens. A third driver is, and Bruce will talk about it, is the LRT station, and the Central Corridor is anticipated to also join the Hiawatha Corridor at that juncture, and the development of a winter garden, a transit hub, transit-oriented development as a station also would be another driver for development.
Mr. Lester, I want to understand the year in which the costs are estimated. The $954 million is in 2008 dollars, did you say?
Madam Chair, no, it is in 2010 dollars.
Okay, so it's in 2010 dollars already. Why then are you adding the construction escalator of $70 million now?
Madam Chair, we're not adding that. I was in response, Madam Chair, members, in response to a question about.
I don't understand how that comes in at this point.
I'm sorry?
I don't understand how that is figured in at this point.
Okay, Madam Chair, we did not add that in. The 954 was predicated on a 2010 construction site. And what I would ask, Madam Chair, is when Craig Skime is up here, he will specifically address that issue and the escalation.
And I ask that because we've had a lot of discussion here about the capital restoration project,
mm-hmm.
And we stated in the dollars that would be needed to start the project now, And then we talk about an every year delayed in moving forward on that adds a $20 million construction escalator in that. And so I'm confused about why it's already in there rather than what it would be in years after that. But
okay, that's an excellent question, Madam Chair. Mr. Stein
will answer why that's already part of the cost rather than stating it in
that's a formula
2008 and then moving forward with the escalator costs year by year.
That's an excellent question. I'll have Mr. Stein.
Thank you.
Chair.
Senator Tomassoni, and welcome.
Thank you.
My colleague and Senator Sparks, Senator Vandeveer, pleased to have you.
Pleasure to be here. Thank you for inviting us. Mr. Lester, what is the 144,000 square feet? Is that something inside the new design, or is it outside that it's not available right now? How is it available with the new design and it's not available now?
Madam Chair, Senator Tomassoni, this is exterior to the facility itself, and we have a fly-through that shows how it works and set up, but essentially the existing Metrodome would be rotated 90 degrees and pushed back on the site further east, and that would open up property area for development. The Roma Design Group is a world-renowned, in fact, one of their projects that they currently were awarded is the Martin Luther King Memorial on the Capitol Mall, and they've done significant projects in areas that involved a sports facility. Two of the more prominent ones are in San Francisco, where the AT&T Park, the home of the San Francisco Giants, they did the master planning in the area around that baseball park. They also worked on Petco Field, which is in San Diego, and also involved master development work around it to maximize and integrate a sports facility into the overall development. The stadium provides a new front door to the city, as we said, and that refers to Senator Tomassoni's question. We'll talk about that in a few minutes. And the enhanced transit hub of the Winter Garden also we'll talk about. What we'll be creating here, hopefully, will be created as a new live-work neighborhood in downtown in an area of Minneapolis that is currently underdeveloped, and it will be consistent with the city's adopted master plan. It was very important to us to not look at something that competed with retail in downtown Minneapolis. There's already been a significant investment made in that, and not compete with the Mall of America, where we already have a retail center, but to find its own unique, and Bruce can talk to that, own unique live-work neighborhood in the downtown east portion of Minneapolis. The redevelopment is the right answer, we believe, because it delivers the most benefits. Its costs are comparable to other projects. Other options are not feasible or are cost prohibitive. This creates benefits beyond the stadium site, and it enables us to design a solution for the next 30 years, and it also addresses a need that we see as we approach the end of the Viking Games agreement. And with that, I'd like, Madam Chair, to introduce Mr. Skime. Craig Skime is a principal with CSL, which is locally based, but has worked with really many, many professional franchises and also represented the public side in many of these deals as well. He's eminently qualified, and they happen to be based here in Minnesota, so they're an extremely important asset for these kinds of projects. Greg?
Welcome to the committee, and if you'd identify yourself, please, for the record.
Thank you. I will do so. Again, my name is Craig Skime. I'm with CSL International. We are a consulting firm based here in Minnesota. We are involved in projects all across the country that involve the development of professional and collegiate sports facilities, and have been very pleased to be able to work with the Sports Commission and be here today. So, Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. And I'd like to take you through a few slides. I've changed the order just a little bit just so that we can keep it going here and not make it so easy. So if you're following along in your packet, I'm going to start with a slide that looks like that, which is probably your fourth slide under my presentation. Then we'll go back into the detail. So what I'd like to do is talk a little bit today about funding and some of the project costs from various NFL stadiums around the country to put some perspective to this project and some of the cost issues that have been raised. Secondly, I'd like to talk about some of the funding sources. So we'll go into different discussion of various projects and how they were funded. Our goal today is not to come up with a funding plan for this project, but to set the context of other projects around the country, the types of things that have been done with those projects and the various participants in those fundings. The first chart you see in front of you shows project cost for facilities on a timeline. We start at the bottom of the chart in 1997 with the Washington Redskins facility, and we move to the top of the chart, which is the Dallas Cowboys facility, which is under construction as we speak, anticipated to open in 2009. If you take that chart, you also – well, two other things. One, you will see there are two colors in that chart. One shows the private development and the other the public development portion and the dollars related to that breakdown for each of these projects. But if you take that chart and you take the first five projects from the bottom, those were developed in 1997 to 1999, and you'll see generally that cost is in a $200 to $300 million range for those facilities. As you take the next band of years, which actually runs from 2000 to about 2003, there are 10 facilities in that group, and again, generally, they run between $400 and $500 million. There are a couple exceptions, including Lambeau, which was lower, and Pittsburgh, which was lower. But generally, you're looking into the $400 million range, give or take, $400 to $500 million. Then there was kind of a break between 2003 and 2006, and you see the Cardinals facility, the University of Phoenix Stadium, which is now open, which was a $471 million project in 2006. The Indianapolis Colts is a $675 million project, and that's under construction as we speak. And then finally, the Cowboys at $932. What you see from this chart is the escalation of cost, and certainly the, kind of the hyper-escalation, if you will, after 2003 leading into facilities that are coming online now. And I think we're all probably pretty familiar with what's happened to construction costs in the increase in generally materials, labor, and things across the board. And you see that reflected in this chart.
Madam Chair.
Senator Dibble.
Two questions. Are these all reflected in same-year dollars?
No, these are in year-built dollars, Madam Chair.
Okay.
Senator.
So we need to...
Right, and that's what, and part of what that is showing is the inflation impact. I mean, if you did that project then, you hear people talk about it was a $200 million project. One, that was, you know, several years ago, and two, you can see the impact of the escalation of costs.
Right, right. Okay, well, okay, that helps. That helps. But also, Madam Chair, we need to factor for normal inflation as well. You know, there's building costs inflation, which outstrip general inflation. We understand that. The other question I have, Madam Chair, is. Is there also a qualitative difference between, you know, the 2003 and earlier generation? I mean, are our teams wanting, or is the NFL wanting more jazzy facilities?
Mr. Skye.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Senator. I think that's certainly some of it. Obviously, the facilities themselves have continued to improve themselves in terms of technology, in terms of finish, in terms of square footage, other types of things. So I think, yes, you have seen some increase in the type of venue as time goes by with many things. Things are improved upon. And then also the components themselves. Some of them are open-air facilities that were built. Now you're seeing more of the retractable roof-type facilities. So there's changes also in the scope themselves and projects. So this is really taking a pretty broad look at it and saying if you just looked at projects that were delivered 10, 12 years ago and moving that forward, here's what this looks like. But I think there has been some increase in the facility. And obviously the goal will be to build a facility that can have the longest livelihood as possible going forward.
Thank you.
Are the capacities similar in the stadiums that have been built in the last 5 years, or are they dramatically different in terms of number of seats?
Madam Chair, I think you'll find they're generally similar. You see a general range. Some are a little larger, some are a little smaller, but generally they're consistent.
Are they similar to what the Metrodome is now for football?
Yes, maybe slightly higher, but generally in that range. You see a lot of them in the 60 to 70 range is kind of a typical, 60,000 to 70,000 seats is a pretty typical range of facility.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lester, and then... whoever was over here, Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, usually build them so they're expandable to 72,000, and that qualifies you to bid for a Super Bowl. Which is an important aspect. And if you're trying to host an NCAA Final Four, the latest model is to put the court right in the middle and sell 70,000 seats. So which is a long way from Tipperary if you're way up there, but most people just want to be part of a special event like that. So they see some variations due to that, the kind of events you kind of attract. And also the composition of the seats, 64,000 in the Metrodome does not include any club seats, for example, which are relatively new.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Skeim, is there a breakout of which, if any, of these were remodel projects versus a completely new redevelopment? Can you tell us which, if any, are remodeled?
Madam Chair, Senator, indeed. I don't think it's broke out specifically, but if you go down the chart, and I'm going to have to give a little bit longer answer probably than simply renovated, the Chicago Bears project was a renovation, but candidly it was basically a rebuild. So it was a significant renovation. Very little was kept to compare to what is new.
Did your firm have anything to do with that project?
We were involved in that project, yes.
And the client was?
It's very ugly.
We aren't designers. We'll let Bruce take those questions. We work on the economic side, so. but thank you.
Madam Chair, I believe part of the situation they were attempting to retain the columns from the original Soldiers Field, and so
just my opinion,
there's been a lot of commentary. When we toured the facility, I think everybody agreed that that was probably a fairly accurate comment.
With that, I'll try another one. Green Bay Lambo was a renovation, and you can see that cost there. And in that case, the bowl was really kept intact. If you've been there, the exterior was redone with suites and some seating built around the existing bowl and concourses added. But there, the core seating bowl was actually left intact. And now you can see that reflected kind of in that cost. Those are probably the significant ones, the significant renovations.
Senator Roebling.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm wondering, when we talk about the private funding, is it mainly owners of teams or is it large contributions from the NFL? Because I'm understanding that they are ready to make some kind of a contribution to this project as well.
Mr. Skeim.
Madam Chair, Senator, when you look at the private funding here, it is, and this will get into definition, but it is a team owner and or NFL. NFL had a program referred to as G3, which you may have heard, which is a program that was available to team owners to, in essence, get a loan for monies that ultimately will be driven out of the stadium, primarily from some of its premium seating, club seating, that then goes back into that funding pool. So when you do look at the private investment here, it is a combination of individual owner equity, some vendor equity, i.e. maybe they use concessionaire money or other types of things, or they use some PSLs are in there, the seat license, and or also the G3, which is a primary funding and has been a primary funding vehicle of several of these projects.
Madam Chair.
Senator Roebling.
And is that funding still available? The NFL is still offering that program?
Madam Chair, Senator, I'll let Mr. Bagley maybe hit that in more detail when he gets here about where it's at today. But the program per se, the G3 program has ended, but there is talk about other types of ways to participate in funding, and Mr. Lester may be able to give more detail on that.
Thank you.
Or Lester, Mr. Lester. Lester. Wrong Lester, yes.
Figure that out.
Okay. I'd like to move then on to the next slide in the packet, stadium funding. And now we're looking at a percentage of public and private finance as you look at this. And one of the things you'll see is that there isn't a lot of consistency. You see areas where there was a significant portion of private and or a significant portion of public finance in these projects. And as you go through time, you may be able to draw a little bit of correlation, but really it's pretty random in terms of the different participations. And what you find is the public-private split really is unique to each and every market. It certainly has to do with the marketplace, which includes issues of the demographics, the corporate base, the competition within those markets, various other factors that go into play in each of these. So as we look through this and we look for guidance as you go forward, again, each of these markets has their own unique areas and its own unique blend of public-private finance, but this gives a good picture of where you've seen those, with the Cowboys at close to a 50-50, and you can look down the slide, whereas the Indianapolis Colts, another project that's under construction as we speak, was really 85% public and 15% private. You look at Philadelphia, it was more private than public. So you can see it's kind of across the board, but provides a guideline for that.
One of the things that I'm curious about with regard to the public participation is the degree to which in each of these venues their state legislature was involved as opposed to city or county government or a regional government, if they have one. Indianapolis is a mega city or whatever they, I don't know what they call that, but it's more than just, it's more than just like downtown or more than just a city like Minneapolis, for example. In which of those was there public participation in the decision making over the public participation? That is where a vote of the people was part of the public financing issue, and whether that was done simply by the government calling for a referendum or whether there was a citizen initiative, which we don't allow in Minnesota, but I'd be curious about how those came about. And some part of the discussion as it's going along.
Madam Chair, if I can just certainly don't have that information today. Some of that information is all of it's definitely available. Mm-hmm. You started with the first part of the question, and I kind of misplaced that. But in terms of referendums and those types of things, you can see what those were.
Who made the decision? I think that I think everybody thinks that assumes that in Minnesota for professional stadiums and or for the Gophers, that a policy decision as well as a funding decision, whether it was permissive or mandatory, that the proposal had to come to the state legislature. And my question is, was that the case in other venues as well, that the state legislature was involved, or in some areas was it just a city or a county or a regional government organization?
Madam Chair, we'll do a chart that breaks them out by, because it's a mix and match, but I think for your purposes it would be better if we did a little analysis. But it is the state, the county, Tri-County, Maricopa County, and Phoenix, sometimes a six-county region like Denver. And we can break that out and show what percentage came from which unit of or what entity of government.
And who made the decision?
And the decision-making process.
Who made the decision?
Okay. Madam Chair, we'll get that to you.
Thank you. Senator Tomasoni.
Maybe Senator Rest's question is which states were red states and which states were blue states. I do have a serious question. Obviously, in the case of the Bears and the Packers, it's not exactly the same site. But are all of these on the same site as before? And did any of them actually keep the old one and find a different use for it as opposed to knocking it down and building a new one?
Mr. Skymer, Mr. Lester?
Madam Chair, Senator, actually, when the footprint is big enough, the preference is to build it adjacent to the existing facility, which is happening in Indianapolis, because then you can use it until the new facility is ready. Pittsburgh, Cincinnati, all of those places, Seattle, all of those were able to leave the existing facility in place and then build adjacent. There isn't.
With the intention of demolishing the old facility once the new one was built and have that for development?
That is correct, Madam Chair, or parking or other uses. But in my knowledge, I don't know of anywhere they kept the old one up for alternative uses. It's usually prohibitively expensive to do it for the return you can get back out of it.
RFK Stadium.
Washington.
Washington.
Yeah.
Apparently did that.
RFK Stadium is still there.
Madam Chair, right. Senator, I was talking about the same footprint.
Oh, right. Okay.
But you are correct. RFK was also used and will be used until the new Nationals open.
Okay.
Madam Chair, also, as we move to the next slides, some of the information on the question you asked about who participated in the funding, you will actually see detailed under the public sources. It doesn't have the percentage per se for each individual component of government or subunit, but it does talk about the different participants and the percentage overall and the way that they participated. So as an example in front of you and on this chart, you can see the Cowboys Stadium, again, to open in 2009, projected cost $932 million. You see the breakdown again between public and private funding. And then you see the public funding sources. In this case, it was a 0.5% city sales tax increase, a 2% hotel motel tax, a 6% city car rental, an admissions tax, some parking tax, and a county contribution, as an example. So each of these projects is lined out as you go through here. Indianapolis, Phoenix, again, going down the same chronology. A couple of things to note, to your point, you see there Dallas, obviously, city participation. As you move to Indianapolis, you see more county and, in fact, multi-county participation. I'm going to switch to the next slide. You'll see, again, some different things. You actually see in Quest Field, which is Seattle in the middle, some state lottery proceeds, some other regional taxes that were part of that. As you move to the final slide of that, again, you see various types of funding sources that were used with various types of participation. So that information in some level of detail is certainly provided as a part of your packet. If you look at some specifically, I have three case studies I'd just like to go through in a little bit more detail again, and we've talked about them actually leading into this, so I probably won't spend too much time on them. But the first was the new Cowboys Stadium, which we've talked about several times. Again, $932 million is the working cost number. The breakdown of public and private financing. You will see a pretty detailed footnote there about how public-private financing is counted. And indeed, some of that was done as a part of their lease in order to determine the public-private percentages. But largely, again, city sales tax, city hotel motel tax, car rentals, and the like. As you move to Indianapolis, again, this was an example of a much larger participation part on the public sector than the private, 85-25, $100 million of private slash team, the public county taxes, and then you did see, as Mr. Lester referred to, a 1% increase on the 6 countywide tax.
Madam Chair. On the Cowboys Stadium, what do they anticipate the ticket prices are going to be?
Madam Chair.
I'll be curious about estimates at the type of facility that $954 million gives us to. What are the range of ticket costs going to be? But what are they thinking at the Cowboys Stadium? Do you know?
Madam Chair, that's actually another project we're working on. And as you do look at that, it's hard to say what the ticket cost is because there's so many different levels of tickets and so many different types of seating. But they are significant in that case. There is a fare increase from the existing facility. However, there is a full range of tickets, which is important. So they still maintain a full spectrum of ticket prices from, I guess the word would be very reasonable, to very high-end if
so
you
the,
choose to
the
do
nosebleed
so.
The nosebleed seats will cost what?
I don't have that exact breakdown, but eventually that seating chart
first
and pricing
$50?
Chart will come out. Yeah.
I mean, is it like $50 seats?
Yeah, price? Certainly as you look at the main part of the lower bowl, it'll be, certainly be that plus. But as you move to different parts of the stadium again, there'll be a full spectrum of pricing.
Madam Chair.
Mr. Lester.
That's a good question, but the average doesn't tell you everything. For example, in the Metrodome.
I was asking, like, for the range.
Right.
I understand.
What will happen is there will be some low end in the up by the scoreboard in the ends that are going to be more modestly priced. But now if you have that demographic that can afford a private suite versus the one who can afford a season ticket, in between, there's a huge demographic that they are attempting to get at. So somebody will pay $400 a game for a ticket to sit in a club and have all the amenities and parking and everything that goes into that, because they can and they feel like getting more return for it. That pushes the average ticket price up, but you still have the range of options. Mm-hmm. It's not as inexpensive or as affordable as baseball, for example, where you have so much inventory. We're talking about 10 games times 65,000, so 650,000 seats, but there will be, it would also be a good question to direct at the Minnesota Vikings as well, who set the price for those tickets.
Okay. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious to know if, as we're calculating the cost of all of these stadiums, we're including the public side improvements, the infrastructure, the accessory roads, the lighting, the sewer, the, you know, all the public side stuff, the stuff outside of the footprint of the particular stadium, not counting
that,
the parking,
of course, the parking structures. $954 million for the Minneapolis site. There was infrastructure, additional infrastructure that would be needed that I thought was, well, I don't
know. There's an 1,100 car ramp needed to take care of the parking needs, and that cost is in the 954. But I think the senator is referring to the broader investment made in roadways, access for ingress and egress to the stadium, all of those others, and we don't have that. I don't think Craig has that in his calculations.
Madam Chair, Senator, in some cases, what this does capture is project costs that are reported as a part of the project. So there certainly are some of those numbers in some of those, and again, it's almost impossible to compare apples to apples. If some sort of infrastructure was done as a part of a different process or not directly related to the project, it wouldn't be in there. But things certainly, as you start on the site and site improvements and move out, the closer to the building, the more likely they are all inclusive. And then as you move out, different things for some of the different projects.
Thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you. First, thank you for the invitation to be here. And a question for you. I didn't know if we were doing stadiums today because it was National Torture Remembrance Day, or we'd be back to these again. But anyway, I have a question on the Cowboys' contribution, if I could, just so I can understand this. It shows the $390 million, and then there's a discussion of it below, and I'm wondering how they... It refers to the ticket tax and the parking tax as being considered part of that. How did that tie into the 390? If you
Madam Chair, Senator, if you look at that chart, you will see a breakout of the admissions and parking tax, and in many cases, what you find in this is not something we'll be able to solve here today, but in some communities, admissions tax is considered part of the private contribution, in some cases considered part of the public contribution. They particularly said in their project deal that that would be counted as a part of the Cowboys' contribution. So that's what you see in this breakdown. You will see the footnote, or I'm sorry, the other way around. You can, well, let me back off. When they originally put this deal together, it was done on a 50-50 cost basis. The costs have since gone up, largely because of changes to the stadium that the Cowboys have put in and funded. So you can see the various participation levels on the chart and in the footnote as it relates to whether these were public or private contributions. But the admissions tax for this part was considered in the original part as a part of that public contribution. But again, different buildings in different cities look at those differently, but that was an agreed-to allocation as a part of their original funding.
So,
Senator Vandiver,
if of the 390, and then I'm a little bit.
The 390 is a separate number, and then the admissions
they wrote a check
is
out
on
for
top.
That?
They are responsible for funding what is not. There is the public funding. Anything beyond that, per se, they are responsible for funding.
Well, if the ticket tax and the parking tax were considered the part of the private contribution, is that included in the 390, I guess, is what I'm...
No, it is not. That would be on top of the 390.
Thank you.
Madam Chair. Senator Roebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Do you know when they are saying they added a half-cent city sales tax, what was their original base sales tax?
Madam Chair, Senator, I don't have that information off the top of my tongue or tip of my tongue at this point. We certainly can get that. I don't have that available.
I would appreciate that. I think that, you know, we can look at our state sales tax and the one in Minneapolis is higher than that already, and I'm just wondering what Dallas's was when they started.
Keeping in mind, too, that on the other hand, that other states' tax systems aren't comparable to ours to start with either, but it's still interesting information. I mean, Texas doesn't have any income tax, for example.
That's true.
Big minimum tax, which we pay, they don't. But okay, yeah. Mr. Skime.
I'd like to jump to the final slide that I have here today, which is just a recap of the various public sources that have been used. So if we took a look at the various projects that we've talked about today, the different NFL stadiums that have been developed, these are the various sources that you've seen that are largely attributed to the public side again, going from the city sales tax, county sales tax, lodging taxes, car rental taxes, on down the list. So it just gives an overview of the various projects. With that, I'd also like to make sure that I address something that was asked earlier about construction cost and how that works and whether how inflation is included or not included. And what I'm going to do quickly is go back to that first slide that I started with. And again, we talked about the timeline of when these projects were built and what their project cost is. And typically what you find is, for example, the Cowboys building, which is set to open in 2009, that building was bought out, or the materials were purchased usually a couple of years ahead of time. So on that project, you might say that was a 2007 buyout of the project. Here what we're talking about is a 2010 buyout with a 2012 opening, and that's why costs were inflated to 2010. That's when it's the anticipated purchase of materials and all the contracts are let, et cetera, leading to the opening in 2012. So the way that it was done, and was done by various architects and contractors who do this thing as a regular course of business, is to take these comparable buildings, to take per square footage costs, take all these different factors, inflate them to a certain dollar, then do some inflation going forward to the buyout. So that's how it ultimately got to the 2010. So there was an inflation factor applied to the buyout date, and that's what would be comparable then to these particular projects.
And that is the construction cost,
which is in 2010 dollars in this case.
Not the not general inflation again. This is the construction escalator.
That is correct, Madam Chair. I believe if you look at the exercise they go through, they look at various cost index. Mm-hmm. They look at the means index and various other construction index to get to that.
I don't recall where I read it, but the if a decision was made that delayed the project for a year, the additional construction escalator amounts to what every year that it's delayed?
Madam Chair, let me address that, and then I'll let Mr. Lester as well. I just want to, again, talk about the exercise that when it was first done, again, you take all these comparable projects, you move it to a certain level, then you use inflation factors. So if 2008 was the baseline, 2009, 2010 buyout was an inflation. Just as a general rule, if that buyout were to move to 2011 because of a delay, there will likely be another increase in construction costs.
Right. No, I understand that. I was just wondering, what is your estimate of what that would be? And I just keep coming back to the capital project. They tell us for the capital project, every year we delay, the escalator cost is $20 million added to whatever cost it is that we would have to bond for if we bonded for the entire project in 1 year, even though obviously not all the construction materials could be purchased in a single year as the project develops. But that's $20 million here, but it's
I think it's about roughly, Madam Chair.
Is it 40-something?
5% of total project costs gives you roughly
your construction escalator cost that you would high.
No, that doesn't. And the further out you go, the more tenuous it gets, because you don't anticipate a steel shortage or inability to get long span steel from Japan or something like that. But then,
at some point, you have to have a
contingency.
Yes, but you'd have to have a drop dead cost that if you're at any point attempting to involve the public, the public participation, like it was at Arlington, is going to be capped at some point. It's not going to, if you have a construction manager, that construction manager is going to, I would assume, is going to be at risk for whatever additional costs there may be.
That's fair.
Yeah, Madam Chair, you see certainly contractors, and then most agreements, as you're probably well aware, do have some sort of a discussion of cost overruns or change orders and how those are handled, but certainly
guaranteed
maximum price, those types of things.
Exactly. Okay. Thank you. Senator Dibble?
Thanks. The question on the public sources of sports facility funding. Some of the ideas, Madam Chair, that have been bandied about in the past on the Twins funding, as well as, you know, as Vikings funding, even the Gophers stadium, talked about sports merchandise, memorabilia, excise tax. Has that ever been used anywhere in the country?
Mr. Skime?
Madam Chair, Senator, I can't think of it right off the top of my head where that has been done. I will say that several of these projects have add-on components to their funding, and some of that may be considered part of that. Certainly in some cases where sales tax is captured as a part of the venue or of venue operations, indirectly it's being considered. But I'd have to go back and look at that in more detail.
In the past, materials with logos on them, whether they were professional sports teams or college teams, were considered as a possible public financing tool. What made it more complicated in Minnesota is that we currently do not tax clothing. And so we get the sports memorabilia industry very, very anxious about what happens in Minnesota, because they charge the same for the materials that they charge elsewhere. And Mr. Lester is smiling, and he knows they get a windfall here in Minnesota. But that has been a topic of discussion over the last 10 years, and funding other sports venues. But it's complicated here, because in almost every other state that has a sales tax, they already apply it to clothing that sports memorabilia, and anything other than that would be an add-on rather than just subjecting it to a sales tax. Yeah. Senator Dibble.
Thanks, Madam Chair. And some other ideas, and I think you just mentioned one, you know, some other kind of increment concepts. You said sales tax at the venue, capturing those but-for tests. Another one talked about is you know, the but-for test on incomes that would be generated you know, as a result of this facility, whether it be the players or you know, all the folks who help build the site, or workers at the site once it's up and running. Is that idea ever been used in other places?
Madam Chair, Senator, those or variances thereof certainly are part of some of these projects. Specifically, first going to your first part about capturing taxes within the venue, the state of Tennessee had some legislation at the state level that allowed for the recapture of in-venue incremental revenue, if you will, and that was part of the project funding. There are a few other states that have things like that. In Florida, they have a deal where if you can show a level of incremental revenue, that you get an annual payment as a part of a rebate, if you will, plan. So different components of that have been used. In terms of some of the other your other thoughts, the incremental taxes or revenues, those have been considered directly or indirectly. In Pittsburgh, there is some tests that goes back to the level of salaries that are generated, and that test is applied every so often as a part of the overall project funding. So there are nuances or direct or indirect places where some of those have been used, yes.
Thank you.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Mr. Skime, how did you pick 1997 as the cutoff year for the stadiums?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think we just tried to pick basically a 10-year window. I don't know that there was any specific nature to it. We certainly have data on others, but it seemed to be a reasonable range.
Madam Chair, it looks like 12 years to me, but what year was the Carolina Stadium built?
I'm trying to think when it was the expansion. That was an expansion team, Madam Chair, Senator. I don't have that specific date, obviously.
Early 90s.
It would have been right, early, mid-90s, right before that. And and for the record, that was largely privately financed facility. There was participation in infrastructure by the public sector, but the facility itself was largely privately financed.
But Madam Chair, that was...
Senator Marty.
In other words, that was right before this when the last privately financed one. Question about the Lucas Oil Stadium one. On it says, and just how we calculate was public and private. In that one, it says it's $575 million from county taxes, and the Colts' contribution is $100 million. Any idea how much the naming rights on that are?
Madam Chair, Senator, I do not have that, no.
But, Madam Chair, Mr. Skime, in effect, if they're $50 million or $40 million, is that probably ballpark what they're...
Certainly that would be in a reasonable range.
And if so, Madam Chair, is that counted as Colt's contribution?
In this case, it is.
I always wonder how we determine what's public and private. It seems to me that this one, other than that tiny slice, is public money. And if we build the stadium, how come they have the naming rights? I mean, isn't that something the public, we build the stadium other than the naming rights practically, isn't that a public contribution as well, because there wouldn't be any naming rights if we didn't build the stadium? I'm just curious how that's determined. That's always calculated as a private contribution?
Well, Senator Marty, don't you think that it ends up being what is negotiated rather than trying to arrive at a determination based on some sort of logic? Because in... as he mentioned earlier, I guess it was the Cowboy Stadium, the admissions tax and the parking tax, which you might think, since the state or the city collects it, would be part of the public contribution, by negotiation was determined to be part of the private contribution, even though the state or the city is collecting it. So... I don't think it's a matter of, in a sense, common sense, and I'm not trying to be sarcastic, but it's not a matter of just what seems to be common sense. It's a matter of what is negotiated either in statute or between whatever public entity and private entities are funding the project.
Madam Chair, I agree with you. I'm just pointing out it's kind of bizarre if we build the building and they get to sell the naming rights. It's a public contribution. Mm-hmm. I mean, depending on, obviously it's negotiated that way, and same thing in the Dallas one, but those are negotiated, but still in trying to measure one stadium against another, how much is public and how much is private, it's a great stretch when it's otherwise all publicly funded to say, well, we'll build it and you can donate the naming rights. Well, that doesn't work. I mean, that's not reality. I'm just saying when we calculate what's public, we should factor those
in. We might come back to that
in.
Same point with regard to who gets the credit for the dollars that are contributed to the Gopher Stadium. Is that should that have been the state's contribution, or is that the university dollars? It's what was negotiated in that bill that determined who was responsible for the contribution that came about because of the naming, what those fields going to be called.
I agree, Madam Chair.
Mr. Skime, did you have further remarks at this time?
Madam Chair.
Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Mr. Skime. As we look at the public sources, are there any stadiums that or any government entities that have looked at this more from a statewide perspective? And I know a number of teams is probably not likely given the fact that some states have multiple teams and that easily becomes a regional asset. Dallas and Houston and Pittsburgh and Philadelphia. And, but in Minnesota, it's the Minnesota Vikings. And we went through this process with the Twins where, you know, it's a statewide asset, but one group
of
taxpayers.
Twins,
well, the Hennepin County Twins. I was one of the folks that had in the House at the time an amendment to name them that that failed. But a number of us felt a little better after we voted on it. But nonetheless, has that approach been used? You know, we are right at the kind of the deadline for next year's bonding process for submitting, I think, to the Department of Finance a request for capital bonding. And you might be interested to know, Mr. Lester, you brought up the Mall of America and not wanting to compete with them. I got a copy of the application the city of Bloomington submitted to the state for its request next year of $192 million in the state capital bonding bill in terms of just an outright general fund appropriation. And those of us, those around the table know that Bloomington legislators have actually not necessarily been hand-in-hand with our city as it relates to asking for public funds for the mall. But nonetheless, that seems to be their foray into how to build their garage. Have the Sports Facilities Commission thought about straight-up public bonding or other statewide sources of revenue? It seems to me if we use the sales tax as the model, it'd be a lot easier if we spread a sales tax increase across the state to build a facility that I think that benefits the entire state, and I'm certainly willing to look at that. But it's kind of a broad question, but I'd like to get your thoughts.
Madam Chair, Senator Larson, if I could respond. We purposely have not brought in a financing plan from the commission with this. This was intended to talk about the art of the possible, to talk about what the vision is, knowing that the policymakers are going to need to be involved as we proceed. And so I think that this is probably a question that's a little premature to us at this particular point. Albeit a good one, because there certainly can be cases made for one of the reasons you would put a dome, put a roof, retractable roof on a facility would be to accommodate people from far reaches of the state. And so you could make a case that this, in fact, is larger than even a multi-county, but in fact is a full regional need. If there are no further questions of Mr. Skime, does that respond to your question, Senator Larson?
Well, Senator Larson.
Madam Chair, and thank you, Mr. Terwilliger, and maybe Mr. Skime can just tell us if he knows of any other projects that have used a more statewide approach. I do notice that in Phoenix, there was, it appears, although there isn't a lot of detail with the pie chart, but it appears that there was income tax recapture and some additional I presume NFL-related income taxes is a capturing the players' taxes and whatever. And then the state sales tax recapture, I'd also be interested maybe even at a later date if more detail can come related to is that the footprint of the development around the stadium? Is it just the stadium only revenues? So there's a couple questions in there, but I am interested to know if any statewide funding has occurred with any of the projects that are on your list.
Madam Chair, Senator, I'd have to go through that list probably in more detail again to refresh myself, but I would say in general there certainly are different levels that the states have participated in. At the high level being various approvals and allowances for different types of taxes to be generated, such in the state of Texas, there was a legislation referred to as the Brimer Bill, which allowed certain things to happen to help fund sports facilities, down to projects such as Tennessee, again, where the state legislation actually says that they will rebate taxes, state taxes, that are generated at the facility itself, versus some broader application, again, in Pennsylvania related to some of those venues where there was actually state money put into the projects with various tests that come back on levels of player income, tax, those types of things as measurement tools. So I would say there's various ways and levels that states have participated across the board. Not in all cases, but certainly, as you can see, there's several of them in which that has been the case. And the specific dollars and the specific areas of focus are unique to each, but certainly that's something that can be further developed. But there has been those types of participations at different levels.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Mr.
Madam Chair, if I might, prior to our next person that we'd like to bring up here, I would like to introduce another member of the Sports Facilities Commission who has joined us during the time that Mr. Skyme was talking, Peggy Lucas, who's sitting in the front row with Commissioner Thrain. So
thank you.
Appreciate that opportunity. Joining us at the table now is Bruce Chamberlain, who's with the firm of Heisington Kegler, and this firm is participated with the Roma design firm as the local arm with them in putting together the proposal that you see in all the pictures and looking at this as it ties together with the Downtown East plans of the City of Minneapolis. So Bruce Chamberlain, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, Committee, my name is Bruce Chamberlain. I'm a principal with Heusington Kogler Group. We're an urban design firm in downtown Minneapolis. We work with communities and private entities really around the state. Primarily looking at community master planning, visioning long-term land use goals, and look at major development projects both within the city and around the state. We've been working in this area for a number of years with the City of Minneapolis and now obviously with the Metropolitan Sports Facilities Commission. We did a master plan for what was called the Downtown East District, which is where the Metrodome sits, as well as the North Loop District, which is on the other side of downtown, and looked at the redevelopment potential for both of those areas. In addressing Senator Dibble's question about why it's taken so long or why the redevelopment vision that may have been envisioned early on when the Metrodome was built, why it hasn't occurred. Projects like this do take decades long, and I'll use the Central Riverfront along the river immediately adjacent to the Metrodome District as an example. The first redevelopment plans for that Central Riverfront were done in the late 60s. The city made a commitment to foster change along the riverfront and downtown at that time, and until what I call the package of amenities and infrastructure were really in place to accept a demanding market, which has happened over the last 8 or 10 years, it wasn't able to put all the pieces together and make that happen. So I think, in my opinion, in this area of the Metrodome, the way it's designed is actually part of the problem. It's very much an inward-oriented building that creates a massive wall that's not a very good neighbor to potential redevelopment or other buildings adjacent to it. And I think that's one of the things with the master plan that we're trying to resolve and rectify and look at not only a sports facility in a new stadium, but look at the district around it and understand how that new sports facility can become part of the fabric of this new district and the vibrancy of this area of downtown Minneapolis. So in the 25 years that the Metrodome has had in its stadium life, it's obviously fulfilled tremendously the venue, the opportunities for that venue to play. And what it maybe hasn't done is respond as well as it could to the district around it. One of the great benefits of looking at a site that already has a stadium on it, as has already been mentioned, is that the infrastructure is in place. And the ability to capitalize on the infrastructure investments that have been made, not only along with construction of the stadium 25 years ago, but more recent investments in LRT, with an LRT stop adjacent to the Metrodome site. So this provides us an opportunity to capitalize on that, as well as the 25,000 structured parking stalls within walking distance of this site. So whereas some stadiums are looking at a location that requires all new infrastructure to be built, all new parking facilities to be built, we can capitalize on the investments that have already been made in this area.
Madam Chair.
So, excuse me. Senator Tomassoni.
Thank you. To your point about the 25,000 parking stalls, on your new development map along Fifth Avenue in Washington, it looks like those are all parking right now. Is that incorrect, or is that, are you thinking of 25,000 new parking stalls? Are you talking about putting ramps there, or what is?
Apart from, Madam Chair, Senator, apart from the surface parking that exists around the Metrodome today, there are 25,000 counted structured parking stalls that are within a walking distance of the Metrodome. So if we discount the surface lots
that,
pardon me?
How far is walking distance?
A half-mile loop. So within a half-mile, we have
I'm getting a little bit older, and my hips aren't.
For you, then, it's 150 yards.
The advantage of LRT, I guess.
But specifically, these sites right here, they look like parking to me.
And they are.
And so, and in your new design, that parking isn't there.
That's correct.
And so are any of those, is that any of that new development that you have in the new design parking ramps, new parking ramps, or are they all envisioned to be some kind of office space or buildings or apartments or whatever?
There certainly would be.
Where does the parking go?
Where does the parking go? As you can see with this concept, with this drawing, the idea is to really create a redeveloped district around the stadium area. And along with the development that would occur, the office and housing uses and some retail, although a minor amount, that would occur in the district, there would certainly be parking constructed within the building footprints that are on the sites. So they would serve not only the office users during the weekday, but opportunities for additional parking for the new stadium users during events as well. But it's not just the uses within the buildings, it's also additional parking to serve those buildings. Does that answer your question?
Well, if it replaces the old parking, yes.
Yep. It would, and then some.
Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Madam Chair, just to comment on parking. Two responses to Senator Thompson. One is the surface lots you see don't provide that much parking. It's the structured parking in downtown that really provides the volume, the numbers of spaces that really give downtown the number of spaces. I mean, people don't even know how much parking is downtown because it's structured. They don't see it. It's not like, you know, parking around a mall, but there's a ton of parking downtown. Some would argue too much because the market has been driven down quite a bit by the availability. And the other is that, you know, these surface lots, from an urban design planning perspective, are not desirable. They don't provide the fiscal benefit, the economic benefit. They don't provide the vitality. They really drain the life out of downtown. It's been a huge issue for a long, long time. So it's probably a good thing that these surface lots would be going away under the development scenario that's being presented for a whole lot of different reasons.
Senator Tomassoni.
Senator Dibble, I don't know that I am discussing whether or not it's a good idea or a bad idea, but I know there are a lot of people parking these lots when I go to these games. How far away is Seven Corners? That's where I park. Is that a half mile?
It's roughly a half mile, probably.
I can still walk that, but
certainly within that range.
It just looks to me like there's a lot of parking there, and that I'm fine with getting rid of it as long as we can park. But I was hoping that the replacement plan is taking into consideration the parking lots that's dismissing. And it looks to me like there's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, at least 10 lots there that are exclusively for parking, and that's a lot of cars for a Twins game or a Vikings game, in this case, a Vikings game. But.
Madam Chair, Senator, one of the things we did is we were looking at the design for the new stadium, and the district around it is gain a full understanding of what the parking requirements would be for a game, as well as what the parking requirements would be for the land uses surrounding the stadium, and account for that in these at least preliminary concepts that we've looked at for this district. So I think it's a very good question and point about parking, and I think Senator Dibble characterized it very well in that surface parking relatively to structured parking is a fairly inefficient way to use the land area. And if there's a demanding market, if there's opportunity for redevelopment and a way to structure parking within buildings, we can take much greater advantage of that land around the stadium. So that's the notion behind that. The new vision for a multi-use stadium.
Excuse me, Senator Larson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And maybe to follow up a little bit on Senator Dibble's questions or comments, Mr. Chamberlain, as it relates to parking. I mean, I think downtown, increasingly with the additional transit options that are currently available and to be available, have you done any significant modeling as it relates to off property parking and use of transit, or you know, folks maybe coming from neighborhoods and using transit? Hiawatha, we know that North Star will be entering the downtown. There are other proposals that perhaps we can't count on as much, but and it seems to me also just based on the facility, increasing additional game day transit options may be part of the way to solve the problem. But I'm wondering how much detailed thought has been gone. Into as it relates to this yet?
Madam Chair, Senator, we actually have looked at that, and it's called traffic demand management, looking at the relationship between folks who drive and folks who use transit, and calculated potential transit users into the parking needs for a game day event. And I think when Mr. Bagley speaks to you, he's going to talk also about how tailgating is handled and how remote tailgating may be able to take advantage of LRT.
Did you have further presentation, Mr. Chamberlain?
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The new vision for the multi-use stadium really expands the visitor experience beyond the stadium walls, which is what the Metrodome is very good at. But we want to take that beyond the stadium walls and really expand that into the district around it. It's on the same land as the current Metrodome sits, but it's shifted to the east. And it shifted over the top of an existing surface parking lot in order to create development opportunity on the downtown side of the new stadium. That development opportunity could be a mix of hotel, office, residential uses, and it creates an entree really into the entry to the stadium and creates that very strong linkage in the future between the stadium and the energy and vibrancy of the city itself. The new stadium takes advantage not only of the freeway infrastructure that we talked about, but also the investments in LRT and potential investments in commuter rail as well. The transit station area adjacent to the Metrodome is the point where the Hiawatha line and the future Central Corridor come together. They come together at that station area. As you continue through downtown on the west side toward the Twin Stadium, the North Star commuter rail line will come into the Twin Stadium, which is linked with LRT that goes to the Metrodome or future stadium area. And then also the possibility someday, which is down the road, of Southwest Corridor also coming into this area. So there are lots of opportunities, I think, to capitalize on those investments to diminish the need for parking facilities around the stadium. If we look at the view to the stadium, what we're suggesting or what's being suggested is a retractable roof, retractable wall stadium that's oriented 90 degrees from where the stadium sits today, so it orients directly toward downtown. Some of you may know that the Minnesota Gopher Stadium is also trying to take advantage of the downtown skyline and has shifted its orientation toward downtown. Skyline view has become so important toward the marketability of any kind of development, including stadiums, and we want to do the same. We're also suggesting creating an events plaza at the foreground to the stadium, and that would be where the primary entry into the stadium is. So it really celebrates the point where people come together and are entering into the stadium. There could be outdoor events as part of internal events, whether it's game day or other events that are taking place in the stadium. So it really can become an indoor-outdoor facility. And when the retractable wall and roof are open, that becomes one large space that truly does take advantage of the notion that this is Minnesota's rec room. It really creates also, one of the things we're suggesting is creating a one-of-a-kind, at least in this region, LRT station. And Mr. Lesser characterized it as a winter garden, and there are other interior LRT stations around the country and around the world that create really tremendous environments to come into a district. And that's one of the things that we're suggesting with this project as well, is to create a multi-use block out of the current LRT station that would allow people to exit and enter the LRT line internally, opportunities for restaurants and those kinds of things. This is a view looking toward the downtown skyline with the Winter Garden LRT station in the foreground. You can see that there's a piece of sculpture, for those of you who are familiar with it, representation of the Stone Arch Bridge that's on that block. The idea would be to keep that artwork, to build the building essentially around it, and make that part of the happenings of that block. The interior of the Winter Garden could house restaurants, cafes, retail venues, as well as the function of the LRT station itself. And this allows us, again, to leverage the in-place transit investments and serve fans and visitors in a way that's very unique, creates a very unique environment and energy and excitement around coming to a game or another event at the stadium. This is an interior stadium view. You can see the downtown skyline in the background. This view is showing the roof closed, but the retractable wall open. And it adds, I think, a level of energy that is hard to replicate, I think, when you have such a tremendous skyline, tremendous downtown building view that this stadium can take advantage of. Obviously, it's climate-controlled to accommodate football games as well as the 300-plus events that are happening in the stadium other days. We also have a fly-through that I'm going to start, if you can give me 1 second. Right in the middle. Okay, that's filling your screen. This is showing the existing aerial and now looking at the stadium. Obviously, the downtown skyline is in the background. Looking westwardly, you can see the river on your right. It shows a little bit of the plaza at the foreground of the stadium and the development that would happen on the stadium site surrounding that plaza. You can see there the lighter blue facility, the triangular piece, is the Winter Garden transit stop with development backing onto that. And obviously the blocks that are currently surface parking are suggesting to be developed. We're looking at or suggesting a package of amenities to support the development, and a one-block park within this district is one of the amenities that we're looking at or suggesting as part of this.
What do you anticipate the turf being?
Chair, the turf will be the new state-of-the-art artificial turf, such as we have now. One brand is Field Turf. It emulates many of the attributes of real grass, but still allows, it has the playability, so you can have all the other events on it.
Senator Vandiver.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chamberlain, it's clear that the Metrodome hasn't spurred the kind of redevelopment that was anticipated, and even with the transit stop that's there, why do you think this is, what is going to make this more successful in that regard?
Madam Chair, Senator, I think there are a number of factors. It's not only one thing, but part of it is that the design for the new stadium would be handled in a way that embraces the street side rather than creating a wall that is only focused on the interior of the stadium. So there might be uses that are created at the street edge that face onto the street along the stadium perimeter. Certainly from a design standpoint, the streetscape would be designed in a way that is very accepting and very inviting for pedestrians. That makes a difference in folks who are interested in investing across the street. So that's one aspect of it. Another is that the LRT station area obviously is relatively young. We've had 2 years of history now with the LRT. In and of itself, it's not enough to spur redevelopment, but it's one of the factors, one of the amenities that's in place that can make that happen. And as I mentioned just a minute ago, we're also suggesting making investments in a new open space within this district, a new park that would support residential uses within the area, and also investment in streetscape that would be made along with the redevelopment around the stadium area. All of those things come into play, making links with the riverfront, with the new Guthrie, the Mill City Museum, the downtown district. The connectivity components of it make all the difference in the world. And I think, frankly, ownership of the blocks surrounding the stadium make all the difference in the world also, and the desire of that ownership and doing redevelopment.
Madam Chair and Mr. Chamberlain, you would be... that is true. You would be more actively involved because of the ownership or the facility owners. One quick question was is the costs that you described the park and the others, is that any of that included in these numbers yet?
Madam Chair, Senator, no, it is not. The notion would be that the development as it occurs around the stadium area would support the infrastructure and amenity creation, whether it's a park or streetscape improvements, what have you. As that development occurs, it would pay for those public amenities and infrastructure pieces.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chamberlain. Senator Dibble, and then I think we'd be ready to hear some brief comments from Mr. Bagley. Is that what you had in mind, Mr. Lester?
That is correct.
Senator Dibble?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And some of these Mr. Bagley could maybe respond to as well when he gets up. Three quick questions. One is, I think you just touched on one. It's the connections to the other parts of downtown up to the river, I think, would be particularly key given the new energy and vitality that we're seeing occur up there, but certainly down to the business core as well as the entertainment districts. What's the vision for creating those sorts of connections?
Mr. Chamberlain?
Madam Chair, Senator, the vision is to use 5th and 4th Streets in order to create the connectivity between the downtown and the stadium district, and to there would be public ways, obviously, to use or to leverage development in order to create very pedestrian-friendly streets on those two particular streets. And then to use Chicago Avenue, which runs directly in front of the Metrodome, as the primary pedestrian linkage from the stadium down to the riverfront. And that connects directly with the plaza along the Guthrie Theater and starts to build on some of the energy that's happening around the stadium area in order to, again, leverage all of those things to make it function as a district.
And actually, I just added a fourth question, if I could. So the other two, I'll just run through them real quickly, or the other three. One is, I'm curious about the level of neighbors and neighborhood involvement. As we know, downtown Minneapolis is a unique sort of downtown. It has a lot of residential base. I represent a good portion of that residential base, and they're usually typically keenly interested in, of course, what's going to be occurring in their midst. And so we're curious about to what extent they have been and will be involved in the development of this master plan and the vision for it. I'm curious about environmental design for the stadium. That's another question. And then final question is related to all of this, and I think you touched on it as well. One of the criticisms of other stadiums, you know, that were supposed to be the state-of-the-art stadiums is that they wanted to be all things to all people and focused all of that energy in the stadium itself, so all the shops, all the retail, all the entertainment, occurred in the facility, which robbed the adjacent areas from those opportunities. So I'm wondering if there's been thought given to that. So it's neighborhood involvement, environmental design, and the kind of the facility, the amenities of the facility itself.
Madam Chair,
Mr.
Senator, I'll take the first 1.5 questions.
All right.
And then Bruce, take the other. We did involve the neighborhood group. We invited them in. They participated. We had a charrette, planning charrette, in which we did included their input, plus then we met again with them and the various, including HCMC and businesses that are on there, but residents from the Elliott Park neighborhood as well. And they were extremely enthusiastic that someone is paying attention to an area in which they live. And so they are optimistic. The connectivity is very important to them. And they're anxious to continue, hopefully, as the project moves forward, to be enlisted in that. And the idea of making the stadium green, I can let Bruce talk to it, but at a number of meetings we've had, it comes up about what we can do to make the stadium green, to enhance our reputation for being environmentally friendly, both in its operation, both in its construction, and how you, because it makes good business sense, and anything that makes good business sense also is very attractive to both the public side and I think now more and more of the private side as well. But I'd like Bruce to talk to that.
Madam Chair, Senator, regarding green design, obviously that's becoming more and more integral to design of especially public facilities. It's something that we discussed as a design team as we were thinking about the stadium as well as the urban design aspects of the area around the stadium. I can't cite any specific elements that at this very early stage of the project that we would suggest being part of the stadium design. But what I can say is I think you have a Sports Facilities Commission who is committed to making sure that this new facility is state-of-the-art in every way, including green design. Did I put words in your mouth, Roy?
Madam Chair, Senator Dibble, no, that is absolutely correct. We have been, that has been part of our discussion, will continue to be, and while it's a little bit preliminary, as Bruce mentioned, it is in the process and will be considered.
And your last question, Senator Dibble.
Oh, just, you know, all the shops and services right inside of the facility versus, you know, adjacent to and nearby.
Well, as I mentioned earlier, the notion would be to create a lively streetscape so that the facility isn't only inward-oriented. It has street life that's facing outward as well. And that would be the goal or the concept behind the stadium design.
Thank you very much, Mr. Terwilliger.
Madam Chair, thank you. What we'd like to do at this point is remind everybody we're talking about a multi-purpose public facility with a retractable roof that is basically houses a lot of events in addition to the primary tenants. In this case, the primary tenant will be the Minnesota Vikings. And so we've asked Lester Bagley from the Vikings, Vice President for Public Affairs and Stadium Development to join us up here. We have been working closely since the end of the year with the Minnesota Vikings to ascertain exactly how this fits together. And also I want to remind people of the sense of urgency that does exist with the Vikings use agreement concluding at the end of the 2011 football season. And it's very important from a standpoint of the economics of this facility, which is being looked at as a public facility, but we do need to have ways to pay the bills. And one of the important ways, obviously, is to have the Minnesota Vikings as our primary tenant. So we've asked Mr. Bagley if he would please try to respond to your questions as well.
Thank you, Mr. Twilger. And I think it's also important, as Mr. Bagley and you are sitting in front of us, that we continue to understand that although you have an obligation with regard to retaining professional sports in the state of Minnesota, that the Sports Facilities Commission is not the spokesperson for the Vikings, and your mission is a different one than the Vikings themselves, and I think we need to keep reminding ourselves of that. And I think you mentioned that at the very beginning of your presentation, and it's in the materials about the
what the obligation, mission, duty, whatever it is you want to call it, is of the Sports Facilities Commission. But one thing it is not is taking on the role of spokesperson for them. Mr. Bagley can do that job ably for them himself.
Madam Chair, to that point, if I could, I certainly appreciate us revisiting this because I think it's important to understand that this body was created by the Sports Facilities Commission was created by this body, the legislature, for the purpose of representing the public and to make certain that everything is balanced as we proceed through. And we intend to continue to do that. We've attempted to do that as we've looked at this, and as we talk to you as policymakers, we need to understand that it's very important that we have a relationship here so that we proceed on with that in mind of protecting the entire state and the various needs that are there as we also address the dual role that we have, which is to retain professional football in Minnesota.
So, Mr. Bagley, welcome to the committee, and if you have anything that you want to say regarding the presentation or the Vikings plans, we're very interested in having your comments.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is Lester Bagley. I'm Vice President of Public Affairs and Stadium Development for the Vikings. Appreciate the opportunity to make just a few brief comments and then be happy to take any questions. And first, we certainly applaud the efforts of the Sports Commission with their work to solve this problem, and we are anxious to move this discussion forward with state and local leaders. We believe the commission has taken the critical first step in solving the state's long-term stadium problem for the Vikings, our fans, as well as for the state of Minnesota. To your point of that regarding the commission, and as Chair Twilliger outlined, they are the agency that is charged with representing the public's interest in stadium discussions, and that's why we appreciate their comments today, and their arguments today have underscored both the statewide benefits of a new facility, a multi-use facility, as well as the urgency in which we need to act. The commission's study answers key questions and provides a vision of what's possible on the Metrodome site as part of a broader potential redevelopment of the downtown east area of Minneapolis. The commission did a great job of developing the best and most workable approach to the problem. They defined a plan that makes a new facility the anchor of a broader economic development package for this region. We also want to make clear to the committee this morning why the Viking organization and ownership agree that the Metrodome site is the best site and best location to construct a new multi-use stadium. Over the last couple of years, we've heard from fans and sponsors and corporate leaders, business leaders, and labor leaders. We've heard from a lot of people that the preference for a new facility is the Metrodome site, but probably more importantly, as the commission and the consultants have pointed out, is this site's existing freeways, light rail, both current Hiawatha Line and future Central Corridor Line that will go through here. Hiawatha Line has 26,000 daily riders, as you know. Central Corridor is projected to have 40,000 daily riders connecting at this site, 66,000 projected riders. So this is a huge piece of it. So the current and future light rail utilities, other existing infrastructure, make it the most cost-efficient site in Minnesota for this facility. And also, as discussed with the committee, as parking and tailgating opportunities near the dome are disappearing each year, there are still 20,000-plus parking spots within a quarter-mile walk or so of the site. Plus, as alluded to, we are working on creating opportunities along the Hiawatha light rail line to kind of put a park-and-ride opportunity, a Viking-branded tailgate experience together, where fans can tailgate and then jump the light rail and ride it to the game and then return, taking cars off the road and as well as encouraging light rail use, but also helping us with our Viking game day experience, which is so important to our fans. So we're confident that we can work with the parking situation at this site. The Winter Garden opportunity of the light rail facility or the light rail station that Mr. Chamberlain talked about is something that the Wilf ownership is very excited about, has had input on, and is very anxious to move that discussion. Have had conversations with Congressman Oberstar in Washington about the issue and explored funding options and solutions, and very excited about that particular piece, both as a stadium, part of the stadium solution, as well as the broader development in the neighborhood in the area. So we strongly agree, excuse me, with the commission that the Metrodome site should be recycled. This is the best location for the next generation of Vikings football, as well as a great number of other community and athletic events. Final point this morning is that this approach to resolving the Viking Stadium issue matches up with the Wilf and the Vikings approach to this, which is an investment approach. Since the Wilf family purchased the Vikings, they've expressed a strong interest in investing in our economy and being part of redeveloping the area around the Metrodome. And as you've seen over the last few weeks and months, they have demonstrated that commitment by investing in property around the Metrodome, the Star Tribune property, central parking lots, and others, as those conversations continue. So we have a tremendous opportunity here to solve this facility issue and generate hundreds of millions of dollars of private money from the Wilf ownership into a new multi-use stadium and broader economic development package that will grow jobs, tax base, and provide an economic boost to our state's economy. In conversations, preliminary conversations, we look forward to more serious conversations, but Mr. Wilf has committed in excess of $1.25 billion into this project, with $250 million toward the stadium, another billion of private dollars into the redevelopment of the downtown East area. So they're sincerely committed to being part of the solution and also leveraging, if you will, the economic development piece to try to help solve the state's facility problem. So thanks again for the opportunity to come before you today. Appreciate the chance to talk about it, and appreciate the fact that this committee or these committees are interested in moving these discussions forward. The commission has laid out a great vision and a solid approach to a solution. We appreciate their leadership. We look forward to working with you, the governor, the public, and arriving at the best decision for the state of Minnesota, as well as the Vikings and our fans. And with that, I'd be happy to answer questions.
Madam Chair.
Senator Vickerman.
Madam Chair, I've been involved in Vikings for a long time. I think it's a good idea, but the $954 million kind of scares me just a little bit. But if you're going to do this, you're going to go statewide. I think you have to. What you have to do is explain to my constituents what they're going to benefit other than the ball game. You have to tell them how much money is going to come in here, and it is divided amongst the whole state. I think that's the key to it. I think that's what you're going to try to do.
Right. Senator Vickerman, members, thank you. Absolutely. The commission alluded to it, tried to underscore it, and we need to be very clear about this is a statewide benefit, the facility as well as the team. This by having the Vikings in Minnesota, it's a statewide benefit, but more specifically to the dollars and the roughly $2 billion project that we're talking about here will benefit the region and statewide with investment in jobs and tax base. The $954 million is a significant number, and it is too high for everyone. It's too high for us, but it is what it is, and if we would have done this project in 2001, it would have been half that. Still a significant number, and you've seen from Mr. Skime's testimony that inflation has driven this up, and that's why I think we need to act to stop it from going even higher, Mr. Chair.
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Mr. Bagley, just a second, Mr. Twilliger. There has been the planning for the community meetings around the state to talk about or to make, I would assume, similar presentations and to get some feedback from the public, not just in the metropolitan area. Do the Vikings intend to be part of those community meetings?
Madam Chair, yes. I think we've had preliminary conversations with the Sports Commission. It's and still yet to be determined is our specific role. We have expressed an interest in participating where needed. We'll follow their lead, and we will do so.
Mr.
Madam Chair, I just, and this is somewhat in response also to Senator Vickerman's comments about listing around the state. This is a statewide need. It's a statewide facility we're talking about. It's a multi-purpose. It's a public facility. We plan during the months of September and October to visit throughout the state, and we will make people aware of what those places are and the dates and locations, et cetera, to go out and really talk about this in an effort to exchange ideas, to explain where things are at, like we're attempting to do here, and to get the input of the public as well coming back in. Hopefully we can have those all concluded by the end of October. That's the plan.
You might want to alert the public officials, that is the legislators in those areas, when you're coming, because they might want to listen in on what their constituents have to say.
Madam Chair, that is our plan. We plan to make certain everybody is aware of dates, time, and we will make an endeavor to include everybody in this so that nobody is caught surprised and they get an opportunity to hear as well.
Senator Vanderveer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Mr. Bagley, I just want to thank you on all the presentations that I've heard from you. I think it demonstrates that the Vikings do care about what my constituents care about and respect the values that they have. Secondly, this is a very nice proposal, but, of course, paying for it is always the issue. And I'm just this was a hot topic at the Legion last night. We were talking about this, and one of the questions that came up, and I don't know what exactly how they did it, but Green Bay was able to put something together to build a stadium, or there's some community ownership, or there's some arrangement there that seems to make it more palatable. Do you know, is anyone here know about that, or why we couldn't take an approach where there was more, for this big a stake in public money, that there was more of the asset held by maybe the people?
Madam Chair, Senator Vanderveer, and it's a good question, I think, and it's been addressed and discussed in previous testimony and as well as on the twin side of the equation. Maybe Mr. Lester can be more clear on it, too, help clarify. But the Green Bay Packers are owned by the community. That they're the only NFL team, I think probably the only professional sports team that's publicly owned. And that they were sort of grandfathered in. Now there's a requirement that in the NFL that one owner, in this case Mr. Wilf, has to be a managing or a general partner, if you will, has to have at least 30% of the equity in the team, so that's the current situation. If you had further comment,
Madam Chair, the community ownership is always been discussed is very important. And another thing the Packers did was sold stock in the team that is not voting stock. It's a level B stock where it's a souvenir essentially, but you own a piece of the, as a method of raising money to go towards bricks and mortar. And they were very successful because, of course, they all worship the Packers. I think any and all options would be, it is not going to be possible to get around the bylaws of the league and have the community purchase the team. That's not going to be an option and hasn't been duplicated anywhere else, even though many people have certainly envied their Packers' ability to do that. And if in the event they are ever sold, the proceeds of that sale go to the VFW Club in Green Bay, Wisconsin. A very little-known fact that everybody...
Senator Roebling.
Now we know where that came from.
If this plan were to move ahead, the Vikings would be left homeless for a couple of seasons. What would be the plans for the interim?
I can, Senator Roebling, members, I think the preliminary discussions that we've had just on a surface level with the University of Minnesota officials is that potentially we could play a couple seasons there. I think this plan does anticipate or presume that the Vikings will be out for 2 years, two seasons, 30 months roughly, I believe it is, for the construction phase. And preliminary conversations with the University of Minnesota, obviously those conversations have to get more serious as we get into hopefully the solution, if this is the solution that we can strike here.
Your other comments? Senator Tomasoni.
Madam Chair, I think I heard Mr. Twilliger say earlier that were there 260 days that the dome has been used a year? Was that the
Madam Chair, Senator Tomasoni, 300 event days a year currently, and of course included in that are the 81 Twins dates, the 6 Gopher dates, and the 10 Viking dates. So you subtract that out, slightly over 200 that are event days, wherein the Cook County Vikings come down and play, or, you know, whatever high school baseball team or whatever would come in, the tractor pulls and such.
Senator Tomasoni.
Obviously, we've figured out that with three stadiums now, we're going to be able to have enough venues and events to make all three of them work. Is that what we've kind of figured out here?
Madam Chair.
I think
Chair,
you need to have one that is able to have an inside and the other two don't.
Keep in mind that this would be the only one of the three that does have a retractable roof. The Twins Stadium, Twins Baseball Park, will not have a roof. Of course, the Gopher Stadium will not, and this will have a retractable roof, which will make it a year-round facility.
But somebody has calculated that there will be enough activity in all three places to make all three places cash flow, I'm assuming. Is that correct?
Well, we haven't gotten into all the financing parts of it, but that will obviously be part of the overall consideration.
Senator Dibble.
Madam Chair, I count five facilities in this metro area. You're talking about Excel and Target, Twins, Gophers, and, you know, so. Yeah,
Excel
Vikings,
and Target are not, Target Center are not suitable venues, however, for truck pulls or things like that.
Okay, you delete the truck
some
pulls.
Some indoor events, but not.
Music
not
events and circuses.
Not the versatility that the Metrodome offers. I don't think you'd have a rodeo inside the. Senator
Dimmel. It depends on the rodeo man. Anyways, Mike, I didn't want to jump the gun. Senator Larson's question, if he was going to ask about the NFL contributions, talked about the G3 program that has sunsetted. What there was some allusion to some ability for the NFL to participate in some future program. Or in some other way, what is that?
Mr. Bagley, what is the NFL's plans?
Senator Dibble, members, the G3 program, as alluded to, that fund was exhausted just recently with the deals in New York, the Jets-Giants Stadium, as well as the Kansas City Chiefs facility. So that program, that fund, has been exhausted. It's something which we've testified to over the last few years that this point was coming, that this fund was going to run out of money, and it has. The good news is, although not complete yet, the league is working on a new funding program, and they are committed to at least at the commissioner level and working with other owners, trying to make sure that some league funding assistance program moves forward, but nothing's been finalized as of yet. And I think it's also important to note, as part of this discussion that Senator Marty raised about which part is sort of public and which is private, the G3 fund was a loan that the Wilfs, if we would have gotten one, would have been on the hook to repay. So it is part of, or would be considered part of, the private funding package in a discussion. If I could, just on two other quick points, and if I may, on just Senator Vandeveer and others raised about why the downtown East area had not been developed when the Metrodome was built, and from our perspective, or a couple of reasons. One, it wasn't planned. There was no urban plan, master plan, as Mr. Chamberlain outlined going in, and then the second point didn't have the as alluded to, it didn't have the key player with Mr. Wolf, who's willing to invest in this redevelopment and put significant private capital into the economy, and I just want to come around on that point as well.
Thank you. Are there further questions, Senator Day?
Madam Chair, first off, thanks for bringing this to the front here and sure. During the summer, and I think it's a great plan. I think it's wonderful that we're using land we already have. I think we spent $700 million for a light rail system, and now we're going to use it, which is fine. I think that's really great. And I guess the one thing I want to compliment the Vikings on is that you have an owner that wants to do something, and I hope that Minnesotans, you know, we all can figure out how we can do that to help, because we know you're, and we know the Sports Commission, you guys have done an excellent job in watching our money and running a facility. But one of the things that I really like is that we now have an owner that doesn't say, well, I'll move the team if we don't get this done. There's never been that discussion, and I think that's pretty cool. And you can tell the owner that, because we've talked to, you know, up north, he was in Blaine, and I personally like downtown Minneapolis better. But I think it's good that nobody is any threats or any leveraging is going on, and I think that if all of us have more meetings like this, and Madam Chairman for putting these things on, and we all get to know more about it, we can hopefully figure out a way to get the extra little chunk of money that we're going to need. Probably want to be little, but the chunk of money that we need. So let's all pitch in, see what we can do, and good luck.
The idea for having this meeting actually came from Senator Day. At the end of the session, we had a general discussion after one of the hearings about the kinds of things that this committee should be prepared for and should prepare itself for during the interim in anticipation of legislative proposals or big ideas that were going to come forward next session, and that we really should, any kind of proposal, whether this is the committee of origin or just one stop along the way, certainly we would have some jurisdiction over and oversight over any kind of proposal coming along. So I think this is a good start to inform us, and we certainly will be paying attention to the community meetings and this coming fall and just what our constituents are saying about these proposals, and we really do appreciate the information you provided for us, all of you, today. And on behalf of the committee, I'd like to thank you.
Madam Chair.
Senator Betzel.
Unlike Senator Day, I like
the
Blaine
proposal.
No,
you like the Blaine proposal. On that note, thank you very much,
Madam Chair, thank you very much,
Mr.
members
Twilliger
of the committee.
And others. We're adjourned.
Yeah, we'll just give them spam.
That's right. Well, I